Okay, I think we better start now before more people start moving chairs out into the neighboring room. My name is Anders Weber-Zinker. I'm from Gen Re, and I'm happy to chair today's first afternoon session. The title is entitled Mental Illness and What Next for the Disability Insurance. I give you first some information on housekeeping, which I'm supposed to do. The session will run for 50 minutes. And it will sort of be presented first by the paper, and then we have some time for Q&A. I shall inform you that that you can submit some feedback through the webpage called Summit Connect. I'm sure you have all this already tested and tried, so don't switch off your smartphone, just switch it and put it on silent. If you have a question later on, please use the microphones and identify yourself, because all these sessions are recorded. Let me introduce the two presenters of this paper. They're Kath Watson and Dale Jackson. They both work for EY in the actuarial services team. I start with Kath. She has more than 12 years experience in the life insurance industry and wealth management. Her roles were also involving the support of the appointed actuaries, work in the demutualization and due diligence for mergers and acquisitions. She has also some experience in reserving and valuation. For Dale, he has more than 10 years life insurance experience. He used to be the valuation and product actuary with MLC, and also involved in a wide range of projects, including life insurance commission structures, which I guess should keep him very busy at the moment, customer retention initiatives, also AA support and ICAP reviews. So I think by now I've done my job, because the door is closed, and we can really start now with this paper. So I hand over to Kath.
Thank you for attending our session today on mental illness, what next for disability. Before I dived into the content of our presentation, I thought I'd start with why we're presenting about mental illness today. You may know this woman. She's a fairly high-profile public figure, and what we're seeing out in the world is there's a lot more discussion about mental illness openly. This is an international example, but there's a lot of Australian examples. We're here in Melbourne, so I thought an AFL example is a good one. Geelong's AFL player Mitch Clark has recently disclosed a little bit about his experience with depression and his issues in including a decision to make an early retirement and then thankfully a return just in the last year. If you prefer rugby union, Ben Shoon is a good example. He recently came out and talked about his experience with severe depression and the psychiatric treatment he needed and even his suicide attempt, which was related to troubles after a car accident and severe back pain, ongoing back pain. So that's a little bit about why mental illness. It's very topical, and why in life insurance, why at the Actuary Summit. There's been a lot of speculation in the media that mental illness is one of the leading reasons we're seeing increased claims and poor profitability in the industry, in particular work-related stress claims. So for today's session, we're going to cover a few areas. We're going to start with an introduction. So the purpose of the presentation is to provide actuaries further insight into a variety of different factors that will help determine the level of mental health-related claims into the future. So when we're looking to the future, it's useful to start with a good understanding of what we're talking about in the current situation. So I'll be going through that in the first section in the introduction, which will look at what is mental illness, what are the key drivers, what are the different types, and how does that relate to the industry, and then Dale's going to come and present to you more on the trends that we've been seeing, looking at the past, and how that may influence the directions we're heading to in the future. And that will include a discussion of current industry responses. So So, what is mental illness? I popped up on the screen the definition from FSC Standard 21, which covers education of FSC members for mental health. I'll let you read it for a minute. As you can see, it's quite a wide-ranging definition, and mental illness covers a very wide spectrum of illnesses, ranging from quite mild to quite severe. The flip side, of course, is mental health, and the World Health Organization defines mental health as a state of well-being in which an individual can realize his or her own abilities, can cope with the normal stresses of life, can work productively and fruitfully, and is able to make a contribution to his or her community. So that's the high-level definition. In a minute I'll go and look at specific types. But before that, I just thought I'd talk about some broad facts about mental illness. So the first is it is common. In a study, they found that about 20% of people reported having experienced mental illness in the last 12 months, and people reported in their lifetime, about 45% of them reported suffering a mental illness. Further, in Australia, depression has the third highest burden of all diseases, and World Health Organization has identified that current predictions are that by 2030, depression will be the leading cause of disease burden globally. The second point is it's a broad issue. As I mentioned, it's an international issue. It can affect everyone from all walks of life. And it can have terrible impacts on the individual, including homelessness, increased risk of homelessness, increased risk of incarceration, increased risk of unemployment, etc. It also has broader impacts for the community, as including friends and family and carers, but also more broadly in terms of ability to contribute to society and economic development on that side as well. And the last point I just popped up there is that historically there hasn't been great treatment, and part of that is just access to treatment. About 65% of people with mental illness do not access any treatment. Part of it's due to detection and difficulties in obtaining an accurate diagnosis. And it's particularly, it's more common that men don't seek help than women. And another point there is that there's plenty of research to suggest that delaying treatment reduces the chance of recovery. So this is a big problem. So if we look to specific types of mental illness, I pulled together some statistics from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare website. This is looking at hospital sessions. We thought it best to look at the more severe end, as this is what's leading to insurance claims. There's a couple of key categories. The first I'll point out is the purple section. So this is neurotic stress-related orders and somatoform disorders, and over 90% of these are stress and anxiety related. And the largest section at the bottom there is the mood affective disorders, and about 74% of these are depression disorders. So what we're seeing is a lot of anxiety and a lot of depression are some of the key forms, and we're going to focus on them a little bit coming up. But before we do, I'll just quickly point out the other section there. So you've got the dark blue, which is mental illness related to substance abuse, so drugs and alcohol, excessive consumption. There's the red, which is schizophrenia and similar delusional type disorders. And then the aquas looks like a big group. I've combined a lot of other smaller types of illnesses. Includes a range of adult personality disorders, mental retardation, other psychological development problems, a range of different things. And the last point before I move on from this slide is that it is very common to have more than one mental illness at a time. So about over 40% of the people identified had two or more disorders. Often, for example, a person with depression may choose to try and self-medicate, and that may result in substance abuse overtaking alcohol and drugs. So the next thing I wanted to do was look at some of the drivers for an individual in terms of the key disorders that we've identified, being depression and anxiety. For depression, one of the key factors is long-term factors, which can include social and economic type circumstances. So, for example, long-term unemployment can be a key driver, restricted access to education and ongoing low income can be a problem. It can also be things such as living in an uncaring or abusive relationship. Other areas are long-term stress at work and other environmental factors which can lead to stress, so ongoing inequalities, I suppose, racism, that type of thing, or exposure to disasters and ongoing issues like that. Personal factors also play a key role in leading to depression, and this can include things like family history and other genetic factors. It can include previous mental illness. People who have had a mental illness once are much more likely to suffer a second or subsequent mental illness, just personality type in general, and emotional and social intelligence levels. And another thing I mentioned, that it's common to have more than one type of mental illness, is also quite common if you suffer some sort of other medical illness. That can also lead to depression as well. The next point I've added up here is brain function. There's a lot of research in the medical field about the chemicals in the brain and the issues that can be caused, and there's been development of antidepressants to try and combat this. And then often depression is triggered by specific events. It's not necessarily the major cause, but specific traumatic events, being a victim of assault, for example, can actually generally start the first or second episodes of depression. Anxiety is similar. It is also influenced by external factors that I mentioned earlier, including family history, etc. And the other key driver for anxiety is ongoing stressful events. So again, similar to the long-term factors where you're having a long-term abusive relationship, that type of example. As we're seeing increased claims in workplaces and of our insured population, we wanted to look at specific drivers in the workplace. So this is taken from the World Health Organization and International Labour Organization's paper. It's getting a bit old, but it's still relevant. The two key drivers that they identified are context and content. So context is where you're working, the culture of where you're working, your ability to influence and make decisions and control, and your equipment. So, for example, at one point I worked in an office for probably about a year, and in that office there was no natural light, and I found by the end of the year I really had a changed mood, and it wasn't until I moved to a different office where I had a large amount of natural light again that I'd actually noticed the change. So just things like that can impact you if you're in it in the long term, but also relationships at work are very key in that category. So if you have conflicting relationships, if you're unable to speak up and there's not that culture that was described earlier in the session, to being able to challenge and discuss and productively engage with each other, it can lead to a lot of stress and anxiety for individuals. The second point was around content. This is what you're actually being asked to do, whether you're being underutilised at work and getting frustrated by that, or in fact getting having higher expectations than you're capable of. Also pressures in terms of unrealistic deadlines, that type of thing, and inflexible work arrangements, including shift work, can be quite problematic in terms of increasing stress levels. The next slide is taken actually from a Safe Work Australia paper. So it's looking at workers' compensation. We thought this is a little bit related. And this actually identifies the key causes for the mental stress claims made that were accepted under workers' comp. So you can see the top claim there is work pressure, which was accounted for about 33% of claims. Following that, it's workplace harassment or bullying. So that's where you're looking at the relationships there, and that's about 22%. And then the third, close behind that at 21%, was exposure to workplace or occupational violence. So then just moving on to mental illness and disability insurance. The first point that we wanted to look at was, well, how has the industry as a whole looked at this issue or responded to this issue? So, as I mentioned earlier, the FSC has standards and guidelines on dealing with customers with mental health issues. So that covers the Mental Health Education Program and Training Standard. And it also, there's claims guidelines and underwriting guidelines. And that standard is binding on all FSC members who are APRA registered life companies. And the second point I identified there is Superfriend, which is actually developed by the industry funds and supported by the industry funds, but also financially supported by life insurance companies. And this is a not-for-profit organisation which seeks to end mental health in workplaces or for industry fund members in general. And then the other point is, how significant is it? So this is getting into what we're seeing. And so a recent article identified that income protection, that mental illness has become the second cause of income protection claims, overtaking cancer. There was an UK Actuary magazine article printed last year, which covered a deep investigation of the cause of claims, and it found 27% of income protection claims for females and 29.5% of income protection claims costs for men were from mental illness. And the last point there is around group insurance payments, which are in the order of $160 million per annum for income protection and TPD claims. And before I hand on to Dale, I just wanted to reiterate, these are not necessarily new ideas, but it's very difficult with mental illness claims to assess and manage. They're quite different to your typical broken leg where you can easily identify what's wrong and you have a clear prognosis for the future. With mental illness claims, each case is unique. You need to look at them separately and understand all the factors causing it. There are a lot of diagnostic challenges. It's not always easy to identify what is the main issue and the exact nature of the problem. And there's a lot of interactions with medical profession and amongst insurers, making sure that the correct understanding is had. There's not just one treatment option. There's a range of options available. And as I mentioned earlier, there's multiple issues at play, including other medical factors and other economic factors, for example, unemployment or future retirement nearing, coming close. And they are, of course, long-term nature claims are generally quite long and require specific claims management. So on that note, I'd like to hand over to Dale, who's going to talk about the macro-level trends.
Thanks, Kath. So we've chosen to think about the trends in mental illness and their impact on life insurance claims or life insurance disability claims according to the simple flowchart we have here. So starting with incidence in the population, then thinking about the treatment and management of these disorders, and then going on to, you know, who goes on to make a claim and how long does it go on for. So at each of those phases, there are a number of influences that are going to play a part in determining the ongoing level of claims due to mental illness for disability products. So starting with population incidence, there's going to be economic drivers, and by that I mean the general level of prosperity, but also the distribution of that income, as well as people's perceptions around their standard of living. Societal attitudes also play a part, affecting the stigma surrounding, you know, what it means to report issues and actually seek diagnosis and help. And also workplace practices, how the working environment has changed and the stresses we're placing on ourselves. In terms of treatment and management, whether people get effective treatment for their condition depends, well, firstly on resourcing of the system, but also how effective it is in terms of coordination, targeting, and efficiency. And then, of course, the number of people who go on to make a claim is going to be influenced by benefit definitions, legal interpretations of those definitions, as well as awareness of an understanding of the cover and how people can make a claim. And all of those things also play into how long a claim may go for. So I'm going to, put forward some views around each of those areas and welcome comment at the end, because it is largely a matter of opinion, but bringing together, I guess, some research we've done as well. So in terms of the population statistics, I mean, we've heard the big numbers around mental illness being quite widespread, but it is also a growing problem. According to the number of people who seek help with their GP, so that's commonly an initial starting point, and we see up there, mental health related visits to GPs growing at 5% per annum, and that's on a per capita basis, so not influenced by population growth. So that's sort of our starting point. Looking forward into the future, in terms of economic drivers, there's long been an established link between the unemployment rate and disability claims. Just last week we have the Treasury budget, and so the forecast for unemployment is for it to be relatively stable, peaking at around 6.5% and perhaps improving a little bit in the next few years after that. But there's, I think, quite a number of other economic-related drivers that are worth considering as well, in particular with their relevance for mental illness. And one of them is around that standard of living or even perceived standard of living. So by many measures, we're working harder and longer, commuting further to work. Job security is not what it used to be. And in terms of real wage growth, we're seeing that slow quite considerably. In fact, dipped into negative territory in 2013. We're seeing property prices surge, households taking on more and more debt, and we also see, I guess, greater inequality in the terms of the distribution of income and wealth. So I guess to me it starts to feel a bit like we're working harder but not really getting ahead. And I guess as a society and a population, that's quite possibly is going to have a toll in terms of mental illness in the population. Then I guess looking forward as well in terms of the challenges our economy faces, we've got record low interest rates already. We've got a budget deficit and at some point needs to be balanced. So there is a bit of a lack of stimulus options for governments in order to really kickstart things along. So there is that, I guess, questionable ability of our economy to withstand the next big economic shock. That may be have an influence over mental illness claims in the future. So you're probably wondering why the big red dot. So as I go through each of these, I'll also be, as I say, putting a point of view forward and giving a little red, green or amber rating against these. Reminder that it's, I guess, from the point of view of the life insurer and life insurance claims. So red meaning it's probably not a great outlook for claims in that claims may increase due to this particular factor. So moving on to attitudes and awareness. So many of you might know who this guy is, Dr. Brian Ironwood, the face of the Man Therapy campaign around, awareness and also resources for men suffering symptoms of mental illness. So there's several campaigns aimed at various segments of the community to try and increase awareness in more targeted ways. That awareness is growing. Another question, though, is acceptance and whether people are actually still willing or whether people are becoming more willing to report their symptoms, seek help, take time off work, and really confront the issues they're going through. So I think a stat that was mentioned earlier is that less than half of those with a mental illness actually access treatment. So the stigma still exists. but things are changing a little bit in the modern world. You know, we can access services and advice more from a self-service type basis, which in some ways gets around the stigma, but I think it would be naive to think that there isn't still a large stigma around putting your hand up and saying, you know, I have depression or a mental illness of some sort. And I guess the issue when it comes to life insurance claims is, you know, is that going to change over time? Are people going to become more comfortable in confronting those issues and seeking treatment and taking time off work and ultimately, you know, claiming for a claimable event? So the way that we've looked at this is to think also about the interaction with the economic drivers there. And, you know, in an economic downturn or after an economic shock, that might be the trigger for greater acceptance and greater reporting of mental health issues and actually taking time off work and making claims. So it may be that sort of latent potential for claims that that has a bit of a risk for the life insurance industry there. So that's why it's rated a red dot. So, and then just quickly touching on workplace practices. You know, modern technology means that we can work in more flexible ways, but it also means that we're more connected to work than ever. So not quite sure whether that's a good or a bad thing. But we also see positive things in terms of employers implementing health and wellness programs and the way they treat staff. So that's rated amber in this particular case. Okay. So moving on now to talk more about the health system and treatment and management of people with mental health issues. So we do know that the government has focused more and more in this area and funding has increased. But there is a question of, I guess, how well is the system working and is there room for improvement? So currently, one report mentions there's 16 government agencies funding 140 different individual programs targeting mental health. So there's massive, I guess, coordination challenges there. The same report also questions the targeting of that funding, being more focused, at the end result or treating the symptom rather than the cause. So focused on providing disability support, pensions, acute care, and also through the justice system. So I guess to sum up there, we see potential in the system becoming more efficient, better at treating people with mental illness and therefore that being a positive for the outlook for life insurance disability claims. All right. So moving on now to our views around claim incidence and the influence of changes in benefit definitions. So just to explain the ball that's cut in half, on the left being group insurance, on the right being retail. The reason for that is that more is happening in terms of changes to benefit definitions for group than retail. And we'll go into a bit more detail on that shortly. So again, there's a positive there in terms of potential reduction in number of claims via mental health. Moving on, I guess, to legal interpretation. So at this point, rated amber because things are unlikely to change there. Awareness and understanding of insurance will grow and people will figure out how to claim and be more aware of how they can claim. So that's rated red. But as we say, the effectiveness of treatment and the efficiency within the health system may be a positive. So just want to put that all onto one slide and try and sum it up. So effectively, there are a number of important factors that may play into the outlook for mental health claims for life insurers. Those that threaten to increase the volume of claims are economic factors, as well as greater awareness and sensitivity to mental health, and the two may even coincide. But there are also some reasons for optimism around the room for improvement for how resources are used to treat and manage mental health, and also from changes in benefit definitions, particularly in group insurance. And I'll just take a closer look at those now. So what we're seeing around group TPD definitions is a expanded view of what it means for any job suited by education, training and experience. So that being expanded to encompass a job that you may be suited to after a reasonable amount of retraining or reskilling or rehabilitation. And so to the extent that many mental illness claims relate to workplace or occupation-specific issues, we expect that these types of benefit definition changes will reduce mental illness claims proportionally greater than claims by other causes. But interested in a range of views that you might have around that. Also mentioned that many definitions incorporating a requirement to be under regular and ongoing care, which in some cases for mental illness may be a bit more difficult because of the episodic nature of mental illness and the fact that maybe it is heightened in the work environment rather than outside the work environment. So that may have a role to play as well. In terms of retail insurance, not seeing as much change in benefit definitions just yet. I guess that market is driven by a number of different factors, including research house ratings, and also it's guaranteed renewable business, so changes could only be applied to new business anyway. But at least we are starting to see changes in pricing for retail income protection business. Instead of focus around the benefit definitions in retail, there is quite a lot of focus instead on the claims management capability and also early intervention strategies, wellness programs and the like. So, close to the end. So just to wrap up, mental illness can and does impact anyone from all walks of life. The industry recognises it as a key issue and a leading cause of disability claims. The outlook, I believe, depends on a number of factors, all interacting, economics, societal attitudes, what's happening in workplaces, as well as government funding and coordination around treatment and management, and, of course, what we're actually doing with the products. So I'll leave it there and welcome your questions, comments. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Kath and Dale, for this very enlightening, or shall I say depressing, paper. I also hope that Kath's boot is still fine, even though she hasn't seen natural light for a number of hours. Do you have any questions? If so, please use the microphones and identify yourself. Yes, please.
Andrew Gow from Medibank. Thanks for your paper. Interesting that you had a green against the seeking treatment element in your proposed structure, but at the same time said only 50% of people seek treatment. I would have thought that if only 50% seek treatment, then potentially you could see a doubling of claims just by more people seeking treatment. I realise that the treatment itself is probably a lot of the drivers of the treatment around more integration and more coordination of that is a good thing, but that's likely to come through on the duration of claims rather than the incidence of claims.
So maybe I got some of the indicators there mixed up, but definitely in terms of people's willingness to report, seek treatment and report issues, that is a potential downside for insurers. So if it was rated green, then I agree that it's more likely a red. And the positive is more likely to come through, as you say, from the management and therefore into the duration side of things. So yeah, that makes sense.
Well, maybe people are still looking for some questions or trying to formulate them. Maybe I have a question. We talk a lot about management and claims management of mental illness claims. How about underwriting? Can we select risks better? Do we have a good understanding industries where there's less of a problem regarding mental illness? Can we identify individuals at an earlier stage, at underwriting stage, to perhaps prevent them from accepting on standard rates if that is a problem?
It's a difficult field, that, because the insurance industry wants to be inclusive and wants to offer cover and provide cover to a broad range of people, and just because someone may have had an episode of depression in the past doesn't mean that they're necessarily not deserving of insurance cover in the future. So there is a sort of equity type element to things as well. So it is a big challenge for insurers in lots of respects.
And I'll just add a little bit further to that. There have been changes that we're seeing. Historically there was a lot more exclusion. A lot more declining, and now we're seeing better exclusions in the underwriting process. And looking at things more on a case by case basis, particularly at the retail level when it comes to underwriting.
Does the floor have a question? Yes, there's someone.
Adam Stoltz from AIA. Sorry. It should work. Maybe not. My question is regarding international experience. In the presentation, you had a few statistics from the UK. I mean, more broadly than that, is there any particular lessons to learn from international experience on this, whether it's things not to do or things that we should be doing?
I guess as part of preparing for this presentation, we did take a look at benefit definitions in other countries besides Australia and the UK. But there wasn't anything which stood out, I guess, as a lesson or as a identifier of something that's done differently that's really making a difference. So it seems like a fairly uniformly important challenge around the world.
Hi, Catherine Dell. It's Bronwyn Hardy. Thanks for an interesting paper. Coming from a health insurance background, I was interested to see that life insurers are also looking at things which help lessen the incidence of mental health claims, and I was wondering if you have any information on what life insurers are doing, because I know it's something health insurers are also thinking quite seriously about.
I think there was a session earlier in the day around the sort of vitality type example of wellness programs sort of incorporated into a life insurance product, giving incentive to improve health. So that's general health, but as part of that, capturing mental health as well. So those sorts of examples are what I'd suggest. Yeah.
And then on the group side, there's more interaction with employers, encouragement for early reporting so that people can have better access to early treatments and the insurers can be involved where they can encourage better access to treatment. And one of the things that's been presented in the past is that getting people back to work faster can actually increase their chances of improving more quickly. So that's the sort of thing that they're working on there.
Maybe one observation I can add to the previous question on international comparisons. I'm surprised. I'm relatively new in Australia, 9 months only, and I'm surprised to have been bombarded with the interesting TV advertisement on where men can go to if they have an issue. But I also noticed that the suicide rate here in Australia is higher than in the UK, which I find quite amazing for such a beautiful country. And also the rate of antidepressants being prescribed is extremely high in Australia. So I'm not sure what that really means. It could mean that more people go to a doctor, or it could mean that there are more issues here. Difficult to interpret this always. On claims management, and we all try to be always very objective, and that is that I think the very difficult part always on mental health. What is really required to make that as objective as possible? Do we really need a better definition which everyone understands, or does one need an industry body, industry best practices which one can work along? I'm sort of always hear the discussion about doing this and that, but then when it comes to it, no one knows really how to implement it. Do you have any views on this, how to make it as objectively as possible?
So I guess a starting point is the benefit definitions, but I think it comes back to what we're looking to cover with the product, and I guess part of why mental illness gets a bit of a focus is a belief, whether it's correct or otherwise, that people are malingering on claim or that they're putting it on or so forth. So more objective definitions may help in that regard. But also, I guess, more extensive use of specialists in the assessment of claims and management of claims to get a better assessment of claims from the outset.
The bell only means that we have 5 more minutes, so time for a couple of more questions. Anyone? Andrew.
Hi, Andrew Linfoot from Munich Re. I don't have this information firsthand. It was relayed by a North American colleague of mine who came and helped us deliver a presentation on this topic. He noted that in the US, as part of reforms of that product maybe 15 years ago, there was a benefit limitation imposed on mental and nervous disorders so that it's a maximum of 2 years, whereas typically in Australia we provide it for a lot longer. You didn't mention that when you talked about the international experience you surveyed. Is this potentially a useful tool in Australia, or is the public dissatisfaction with that likely to kill us?
I guess the challenge is having something out there already and taking it away. It's not something that I guess insurers want to be known for as a first mover on. I guess that's the challenge around this and many other aspects of dealing with disability products.
Hi, boy from KPMG. Mental illness, despite the recent attention to it, is not new, and it's certainly not new to insurance. In the 90s, mental illness was identified as a significant issue, and companies actually did try to limit the coverage that we give to mental illness. So there were exclusions and there were also limitation of benefit period, but none of those were found as acceptable by advisors and by the community. So that's kind of the experience answer to Andrew's question. So we tried.
Thanks, Laura.
Okay, then if there are no more comments, we would. I would like to remind you once more to fill in your short presenter feedback survey via Summit Connect. And then I would like to thank once again Kath and Dale for their very interesting paper, and I believe there's still a lot of work to be done to help all those people who are suffering, and at the same time also to make sure that the insurance industry can work with this condition in such a way that we have a sustainable product going forward. So thank you very much, and I have a momentum from the Institute.